Time to hit the brakes. Welcome to Swerve South.
Welcome to a special pop-up edition of Swerve South. I'm Teresa Starkey, the Associate Director of the Sarah Isom Center for Women and Gender Studies. This episode is in conjunction with SaraFest, the center's annual arts and music festival. In this episode, I will be talking to Bill Boyle about the film Tea and Sympathy. Bill is the author of the novels Gravesin, The Lonely Witness, A Friend is a Gift You Give Yourself, and City of Margins, the story collection Death Don't Have No Mercy, and the novella Everything is Broken. His writing on film has appeared in the Oxford American, Crime Reads, and you can check out his new film column, I Wake Up Streaming, in the Southwestern Review online. Hey, so Bill, I've already said I want to say thank you again for being here today and being a part of Swerve South and talking to me about the 1956 film by Vincent Vanelli, Tea and Sympathy, which I know you've probably seen several times, but I only recently came across it. And when I did, it blew my mind. So I'm excited to have a conversation today with you about it. I think there's so much that we can pull out of this film. One of the things that stood out to me is this idea of toxic masculinity, right, is obviously there. And then this notion, right, about the closet. But I want to go ahead and turn things over to you and talk about how you discovered this film. And if I'm not mistaken, it was also adapted from a play.
Right. Yeah. So thanks for having me, by the way. And I'm happy to be here and happy to be talking about this movie, which I love. So I saw it not that long ago for the first time. I guess it's been about 3 years, maybe. I think back in 2017 or 2018, I can't remember. I really started to go on like a Vincent Minnelli tear because I'd seen, you know, there are some of his movies I'd seen years and years ago and loved, and then I just started seeing more of them, and every movie I saw I loved, and I was like, man, I really need to just watch everything that he's made. And so that was how it started. I was just kind of going through the movies of his that I hadn't seen or hadn't seen in a long time. And it was one of the later ones that I came to because it wasn't a film I'd read a lot about or heard a lot about. It wasn't a title that jumped out at me as something mm-hmm. that I'd be, you know, drawn to. And so I just took a chance on it one day. And like you, I was just totally blown away by it and kind of wrecked by it, and just thought it was one of the most gorgeous movies I'd seen. So that was how I kind of came to it. And I know, you know, I when I was on that Minnelli kick, I got this book about him, which is called, I have it here, it's called 100 or More Hidden Things. So I was kind of reading through that, and that was, you know, probably one of the first places I read about the movie. I knew it was a play. I knew Ilya Kazan had directed the play. That was about all I knew until I read the book and kind of read a little bit more about how the movie differed from the book differed from the play because of the production code and the changes they made and stuff like that. So, definitely a film that I think or probably a play too. I haven't read the play, I'm ashamed to say, that if you're kind of drawn to stories of people who are outsiders or outcasted or are different or feel different, it's going to just appeal to you on that level because it's a study in that, really.
Yeah, and I liked one of the, what you said earlier, that this film, that the film, when you see it, it just sort of wrecks you, right? Yeah. It unsettles you. And I think what would be helpful is if we go ahead and just kind of like frame it, right? Yeah. What this film is about. And so go ahead and tell us a little bit about it, right? It's about Tom, and he's a young man. I believe it's his senior year of high school at a prep school.
Yeah, so it's a prep school. I think it's New England. I don't know mm-hmm. if it's ever explicit in the movie, but I'm pretty sure it's New England in the play. He's at this prep school, and it's kind of, he lives in this house with a with I guess he's not a headmaster, but kind of a house master, played by Leif Erikson, and his wife, played by Deborah Carr. And there's a bunch of boys who live in the house and have rooms, and it's kind of this just open, idyllic prep school on the surface, where just kind of boys will be boys kind of operation, you know, very, very 50s, which feels, you know, which part of the thing about this movie that I think I'm drawn to too, is that there's a David Lynch kind of vibe to it, in that, you know, on the surface, everything is pretty and clean, and under the surface, there's all this kind of boiling tension and all these fractured relationships and, you know, struggles with identity. And, you know, so yeah, Tom, who's played by, is his name? John Kerr?
John Kerr. That's right. Kerr. I think it's K E.
It's spelled the same as Deborah Carr, but I know she pronounces it Carr. I think he pronounces it Kerr. I'm not sure. So he strikes up a relationship with Deborah Carr's character, who's the wife of the housemaster figure or whatever he is, and they strike up a friendship, the boys are kind of relentlessly, I guess it's kind of been there all along, but it really kicks up a notch when they find him sewing with the faculty wives one day on the beach, and they really start teasing him and bullying him and calling him sister boy. And he's somebody who is not interested in the things that they're interested in. The other boys at the school, he's, you know, he's interested in sewing, and he's acting. He's playing a role in a play on campus. He's playing the part of a woman, and he plays folk music, and he wants to be a folk musician, and you know, all these things that make him just not fit in. And then they kind of start relentlessly teasing him and bullying him, and his relationship with Deborah Carr's character becomes, you know, a thing he really leans on, and she really leans on, because he reminds her of her first husband, who died when he was 18 and was very sensitive and a tender man, as opposed to her new husband, who's a very gruff and kind of quote unquote masculine guy. So that's just kind of the setup. And then the bulk of the movie, I think, is really about their relationship and the relationship that develops between them. But it also, obviously, you know, the stuff with the other boys comes to a head, and also the stuff with his father, because Tom is a character who lost his mother. His mother disappeared kind of out of his life when he was five or something, and she just wasn't around. And he was raised by his dad, who was also not around much. So he's basically raised by a maid. You know, he's got a very difficult relationship with his dad. His dad wants him to be a you know, quote unquote regular fellow, and Tom is not interested in the things that, you know, his father's interested in. He wants to be accepted for who he is, and his father is just not that kind of person. So there's all these kind of relationships that, you know, in turmoil. And the central action centers around his relationship with Deborah Carr's character.
Yeah, so. And I think one of the things that you were talking about, there's this idea, and I appreciate the reference, right, and the connection to thinking about David Lynch and what's on the surface, but beneath, or even sort of sordidness in terms of people's sort of behavior. Yeah. And it's interesting to me that, as I said, for me, it's this interrogation and critique of sort of this toxic masculinity, and the way that this idea, how we enforce, right, this notion of conformity, when there's this expectation, right, of an alternate or other type of masculinity that has the potential, right, to sort of exist, that has these other types of desires, right, that's this otherness or sort of outsiderness.
Yeah.
And the way that these boys, and even, right, the headmaster is constantly, right, trying to regulate, right, and enforce, right, these normative expectations of what of what this idealized or sort of like gruff type of manhood is.
Right.
And so, all of that tension. So it's there, it's performative, and it's also incredibly tense in terms of thinking about this idea of surveillance that's constantly going on. And then also just in terms of this, there's this sort of element of this underlying violence, right, that always seems to be right beneath the surface there too, Bill. Do you know what I mean? Is that on the outside, this prep school, right, seems idyllic, and they set the story at the beginning. It's sort of a return or a reunion weekend, and then he drops us back sort of into like flashback to tell this sort of story. But the way that this universe, the way that the school is sort of remembered is problematic, because not everything is as it seems, and that beneath the surface, right, there are all these tensions, and I would argue traumas, right, that are there.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, I mean, I went to a all boys Catholic high school. It wasn't like a prep school or boarding school, but it was still an all boys Catholic high school. And so I think I connected with it on some level there. Just, obviously I was in school in the 1990s and it was a very different time, but that same kind of vibe of toxic masculinity was in the air at that school. And, you know, and I was somebody who was was outside of that and was drawn to the arts and wasn't into things that a lot of the guys I went to school with were into, but I had other friends who were in the same boat as me. There was a group of people I knew who were, existed in that school in the daytime and then, had their other lives that they escaped into and interests that they escaped into that weren't just about conforming to the norms. Yeah. But I did connect with it on some level, just having, gone to a school where that feeling was in the air a little bit. And I never, I was never in a frat and I went to a college at a small state school in upstate New York where I don't even think there were frats. So until I moved to Oxford, Mississippi, I didn't really know anything about frat culture other than what I'd seen in the movies, but obviously I've been here for a decade or more, so I've seen what frat culture is and kind of learned what it is a little bit, and you really get that, that comes through in this movie, that kind of toxic frat culture of hazing and just really, just if you don't fit in, you're done, kind of, you're out, so it's really uncomfortable. And I remember the first time watching it, I almost stopped it a couple of times because I was so tense. Just the situation that he's in there. And it's so familiar if you've ever felt kind of outside of the world that you're existing in. And it's really hard to get through some of those parts, but it is also, it's a pretty tender movie and it doesn't go to, we don't see the darkest kind of stuff, I don't think, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I think that's also part of it, Bill, is that we don't necessarily see the darkest part of it, but we intuitively know that that darkness is there.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah, big time.
And so that's the thing too, that's so unsettling. And when you're talking about that idea, it's sort of like these ritualizations of manhood, or in this context of like thinking about how frat culture sort of is functioning as a way of socialization, right, for these boys, the insider, outsider of what it means to be the one that's outsider or who's labeled different, and then how also the rumor mill, right, or gossip, right, are all sort of intricately connected in this way that stigmatization sort of like works, and the anxiety that it can provoke. That scene where, and I'm trying to think of the context for it, Bill, but when they have that bonfire scene and all the boys are dressed in their pajamas, and then you have the faculty, right, and upperclassmen all sort of standing around. I'm trying to remember the context of it. I don't know if it's after a sport event or what it is, but for some reason, right, they have this ritual event where they're all out there in their pajamas, and it's very, right, violent, and having, yeah, right, you're having your pajamas torn off. And then part of what the problem is, the issue is with Tom, is even in that moment, right, he's stigmatized in this ritual of no one, right, performing this sort of Lord of the Flies pajama party, right, on him. So it's super unsettling. And then what's his roommate, right, who end up later moves to another, right, dorm because of his father, right, interjecting. So you can see how surveillance, right, sort of works even between, like, parents. Oh, I heard about what you did at the bonfire. You went in and helped, you know, Tom be a man, so to speak, or however that ritual is sort of functioning. Yeah, tearing off the pajamas. And I noticed that if you look when Tom comes back to the dorm, he's got his pajama, he grabs a pajama top, by the way, as he's running back, right, and puts it on, and he's, you know, clothing or covering himself, but he's got these scratch marks, right, across his chest, which is almost, right, if we're thinking about this idea, it's a scarlet, right, emblazoned mark that's sort of tattooing him, you know?
Yeah, it's such a, I mean, it's a haunting scene, you know, that, I think the setup is that they win some game, and the ritual after that game is to have the underclassmen, the newbies kind of dress up in their pajamas, and then, of course, like you said, they turn it, and instead of attacking him, they form a circle around him, and they say, don't touch sister boy. They call him sister boy.
Right.
Don't touch sister boy. And then his friend Al, who's his roommate, who's basically the only nice guy at this school, as far as we can tell, kind of, you know, to make him feel more normal, rips his pajamas off and, you know, breaks up this circle. And then they have this scene after where Al kind of lays, you know, after his father tells him that he can't room with Tom anymore, that he wants him to move out of this house, that he, you know, he kind of lays bare his own soul and you know, talks about how, you know, a lot of what he's said is a lie. A lot of, you know, what he said about his relationships with girls is a lie. He's never actually even been alone with a girl. Like, so he's just all, I mean, it's all performance. Everything is performance. And you really see that coming through in that stretch of the movie.
No, that's actually a great moment. And you're right, Bill. It is all about, it's about the performativity, right, of this masculinity or these types of manhood, and the way that these figures are so invested, right, in sort of maintaining that, and anything that seems to sort of undermine or question that, right, is a source of, like, anxiety in that sense. But yeah, when he and his friend, they're in that music room together, and he confesses, you know, when I talk about those trips to Boston and all those girls, no, you know, that's not true. Yeah. I'm still, you know, I don't know anything. And so there's this sort of, like, so in that moment, it's an interesting space. And if we're thinking about, like, New England, and I'm bringing in this idea of the scarlet letter, right, and repression, right, there's that confessional kind of moment there, right, that's away, right, it's away from the community, but this is it's a confession that we're bearing witness to, that this young boy, right, is recognizing that he also is wrapped up, right, in this, you know, literally stitched, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a really tough atmosphere, an uncomfortable atmosphere to kind of exist in the world of the movie. But it's also, like, the way it's shot is so gorgeous, and the cinematography in the film is so gorgeous that it's just these sharp contrasts throughout in the movie that are so striking.
Well, aesthetically, it's right. It is. It's amazing. There's this scene, I think it's interesting, where we kind of juxtaposed the inside and outside of spaces, right?
Yeah.
And then, as you're talking about, even though that bonfire scene is sort of is nightmarish, right? But you have these other moments in the film that are sort of dreamlike, and then you have Deborah Carr working her garden and sort of creating sort of this Edenistic space on the outside. Right. That there are moments, Bill, where Tom is actually, you know, helping. cultivate this kind of garden. And so they're kind of, I would say they're kind of creating this kind of space together, but it's on the outside, because on the inside, right, of that house, there seems to be all of this, you know, again, this sort of tension and repression, even within her sort of own domestic space. So, and then at the end, right, her garden is like withered and decayed, that she's, you know,
she's gone. Yeah.
She's gone.
Yeah.
So let's talk about right her character for this for a moment, because we've been spending some time on Tom, right?
Yeah,
but think about her role in this film as well, because I often feel as I was watching this that she's also she is outside oftentimes, like listening to the conversations between her husband or say Tom's father, or she's sort of monitoring the way that others are sort of watching or sort of perceiving Tom.
Yeah, she's just, I mean, she's such a fascinating character with the, you know, with that backstory of having, I mean, I don't want to kind of spoil, I don't know if that's the word to use, but some of her kind of later speeches that she gives about her past and about her husband, who she lost when she was very young. But, you know, it's obviously something that's the thing that's drawn her to Tom is not only that he reminds her of her husband, her first husband, but that he is struggling in the same ways that her first husband did, that he, you know, had this, we find out that he kind of, what led to his death, I'll try to say it in a way that doesn't give it away, but, you know, what led to his death is basically the same sort of kind of pressure that Tom is under. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's so much of the movie, I feel like, is her kind of listening and watching and just kind of standing just on the edge of something and trying to understand how people could be this way or how things are this way or why things are this way. There's such a kind of innocence to her view of the world and Tom's view of the world. And it's being shattered, I think, you know, by what she's seeing.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting. Yeah, I think there's this way that she's even constantly sort of imploring or reaching out right to her husband, right?
Yeah,
and as you say, asking like, does it have to be this way? Why, why can't we talk or why can't we sort of communicate? And so, so she is on the outside, I feel, always looking in and sort of surveilling what's happening with Tom and within the own space of that house and listening to others. And then also trying to reconcile this world and its perhaps reasoning, right, that she sees around her. Here's something interesting that if we're thinking about this idea of sort of like surveillance and kind of watching and how someone's operating or working within this community, I can't think of the waitress's name, Bill.
Ellie Martin.
All right. So that's interesting when we have all of a sudden Ellie Martin brought into this narrative too, right? And it's also about the idea of like how one marks his manhood is perhaps with the wrong kind of woman on the wrong side of town, who is obviously coded, right, as the potential prostitute. But the name of the place that she's working at, is it called The Joint? I think so.
Yeah, it's The Joint.
Yeah, and so there's this moment, even in this way, in terms of thinking about how sort of gender is operating, right, in this community in town, I found it fascinating that all the boys seem to go up to Tom's room, right, to want to be able to look out through, you know, the telescope or whatever, and the object of their gaze, who they're looking at, right, is her. And so there's, again, this is the way that, you know, that surveillance and sexuality are sort of operating and how she works in this film too. And I think, I think her positionality in the film is really kind of interesting because there's that encounter between her and Deborah Carr, right? In the diner and stuff. So that's just me riffing a little bit, Bill, on that.
No, that's one of my favorite sequences. It's also one of the most gorgeous sequences in the movie because it's you see the like really neoned up, like you see the sign and there's some really gorgeous dissolves from Tom in his room to Ellie in the diner. Mm-hmm. And that scene with Deborah Carr comes in with the flowers and gives one to Ellie, just really, really, really beautiful scene. And she is, I mean, rewatched it last night. So it's all really fresh. And she, she really is one of the more fascinating side characters in the movie, for sure. Just there's so much. She kind of reminded me at this time, for some reason, of Cloris Leachman's character in The Last Picture Show. There's this kind of really beautiful sadness to her character that, again, you know, so much of what she has to do is perform all day at the diner. She's just performing, like letting these boys harass her and hit on her and being okay with it. It's just really sad, sad stuff.
No, Bill, that's exactly right, right? And so I also feel like if we're thinking about, there's that sort of Lynchian quality, I'd automatically think, for some reason, I don't know why, it brings diners to mind, right? But that just seems like very Lynchian-esque kind of space, right? Operating in this diner space. But you're right. The idea that even she, right, is performing this tolerance, right, to this, which is interesting to me. I'm going to make this leap now as I say it sort of organically, so bear with me. She makes it's the idea that that same sort of pawing that she has to endure from these boys is the same sort of violence, right, that Tom's going to endure at that horrific nightmare, right, sort of pajama trauma.
Yeah, it's a ritual for them. It's a thing they have every right to do. And she's nothing in the scenario. And she's performing that part. Like, that's is really, really sad. I mean, you know, she's a really tragic character. That's, you know, obviously we don't get a lot of backstory on her or anything, but she's, you know, she's pretty clearly had a tough go of it. And that's, you know, how she's wound up in this place, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I would argue she's displaced just the same way that perhaps Tom is, except each one is coming from a different, perhaps, social or cultural strata, right? Is that right. We learned that she's actually, I don't know, she might have been coming from the city or coming from some sort of theater, and even it's questionable what type of theater she might have been participating in, right? But she's coming to this space, and then she too, right, like Tom, has sort of like landed here, and find themselves in this environment, right? Each one perhaps negotiating this community or enduring this community in these different ways. And it's almost when Tom goes to her room, and that's right, that also is sort of haunting and disturbing, is when he goes and he's attempting to enact, right, this ritual of manhood. You can see that this is something that she herself, right, the knock on the door or the having the cup of coffee, right, you know, I like to turn on the radio, these are sort of these acts of sort of repetition. And you know what, Bill, she's tired, damn it, you know. She's tired of this town, she's tired of this moment,
and she doesn't know how to respond when he doesn't hit his cues, because he doesn't hit his cues, he doesn't know how to play the part that he's supposed to be playing. And it freaks her out. She gets very kind of spooked by him. That's a great scene.
Yeah. And that's actually nicely put too, Bill, at this moment that it interrupts her script, right, that she sort of enacts and performs, right? As a part of the machinations, the way this town or the way that this school operates, perhaps, and impacts people's lives. So, let's talk about, right, this, the movie, and think about the ending of it. What stands out to you? Because as you said earlier, you're talking about the juxtaposition to way that Minnelli is, like, the film is aesthetically structured, and there are all these almost moments of like this dreamscape, right, sensation or feeling. And we kind of feel that there's that really haunting sort of moment in the woods between Deborah Carr and Tom.
I haven't read the play, but apparently there's some pretty significant differences between the play and the film, and, you know, and that wasn't on Minnelli. It wasn't Minnelli's choice. It was more like stuff imposed on them by the code. You know, there's a character. Apparently, there's a character in the play that's a teacher. A young male teacher who is clearly gay, and he and Tom go swimming together naked. Mm-hmm. And the teacher is fired, and that's when Tom's trouble begins, kind of.
Yeah.
Because, so I think that's one of the changes. And one of the other ones I think is really, based on what I remember from reading, is the ending and just kind of this idea that she, I can't remember what happens in the play, but the idea that she has to be kind of punished for her part in this.
Yeah.
Because she kind of winds up giving him, what is the guy, this Mark Griffin who wrote the book on Minnelli calls it philanthropic infidelity, that she's kind of, or erotic charity or something like that.
Right.
That she kind of takes over where his attempts with Ellie fail, and kind of is like, well, this is going to happen between us. So I think, you know, it's hard to think about what the film might have done had they not been under the constraints of the code. But I think Minnelli is just so good at kind of getting the feeling through anyway, because the movie is kind of infused with this kind of taboo stuff, and you know he's an expert at probably adhering to the code of the day, but also making you, which is why I think the film has endured and plays so well today, because so much of that stuff is under the surface. So yeah, the ending is this really beautiful scene with them in the woods, and then the coda where he reads her letter, which is I think one of the things they really had to add in there to try to get by the production code people. But it's still really, I'm really, you know, really affected by it. And I, you know, I don't have the source material yet to compare it to, because I haven't read it, but it's a really wonderful ending, and tender and yeah, sad. I mean, it's a sad movie all the way through, really.
Well, and it's when you're talking about this sort of infidelity that she participates in with him in this moment, again, as I said, it's shrouded in this woodland area. And it's and you're right. For me, it's almost as if she is not the threatening Mrs. Robinson that we'll see, right? Later, right? there's that. It's couched in sort of this benevolent, right, domesticity that's there in terms of this sacrifice that she's giving. But it's also complicated, because she knows, right? She is sacrificing something in that domestic space. As you're making the case later, we discover when Tom comes back and he's reading the letter, right? And because of the code, right, she has been punished, or she's been ostracized, right? But nonetheless, right, she participated sort of in this moment, right? We just have to have that letter at the end where it's like, oh, you know, I'm drifting along, and maybe she's not happy, right? But that letter is what sort of couches that. If we hadn't had, even though that letter is effective, if we hadn't had that, right, there's that moment in the garden for sort of both of them. You know.
Yeah, and he's become a writer and has written a novel about the experience, apparently.
That's
the
right.
And she says in her letter that she read the book, and he really portrayed her as a saint, which I really like, because that's kind of the way of, I mean, the way that she's ostracized, which is really only through the letter do we find out that
that's
she's
right.
kind of been chased out, is pretty. It's not like her life, you know, we don't get a sense that her life is a living hell now or anything. It's just she lives somewhere near Chicago. That's all we find out. She's like been banished outside of Chicago.
She's riding the rail, right, or something, you know. It's real. And then there's that line, and I know that if you think of me and talk to me, I know you will. And I'm paraphrasing it here, right? Be kind, right?
Yeah. That was the line that was kind of posterized, which is really, it's like on all the posters for it, and it was kind of the famous line, I guess. I mean, it's really beautiful ending in a lot of ways. I mean, it does also, I mean, I think it potentially makes people view the movie only one way, but I don't think that that's, you know, I don't find it limiting in terms of their relationship and his kind of closeted life, and you know, it's really lovely ending.
Well, it is. And then also, I think it's interesting, Bill, and this is one thing I'd like to touch on before we wrap, is that thinking about what's fascinating is the juxtaposition between when he returns to the house and he discovers the headmaster for the house doing the same sort of behavior, doing the same sort of thing that he had done as a young man while he was there, that was suspect and sort of a questionable. He's the one sitting alone, listening to the classical music, right? And
he's a character. The Leif Erikson character is a character we see throughout the movie, and that's the first time you really see who, like, the real him. You know, the person that she probably fell in love with, because the rest of the time he's just this obnoxious kind of coach type, fratty type dude. And then in the end, when he's broken and sad and alone with his music, you really see him, and you see the kind of nice version of him, the true version of him. It's a really touching scene. And he, you know, what I love about that scene is he gives Tom the letter, which is, that other version of him that we see throughout the movie, I don't feel like would have ever done that. Wouldn't have saved the letter, certainly wouldn't have given it to his, kind of nemesis in some way.
Who he was cuckolded by? Is that the word?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's right. The fact that he saves it and has had it and the ability to give it to Tom. But yeah, that even that moment is sort of striking and poignant, where he's sort of sitting there, and that in a way he's a victim of this whole system of enacting this type of manhood that's very sort of conforming and restrictive. And that's all I can say.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, one other thing if you really dig into Vincent Minnelli's life and work, he's such a, interesting, compelling filmmaker always, I think. But, I was just rereading this section of the book on the movie, and just to see that this was, to him, probably the most personal film he ever made, because he felt like he was Tom, he felt like that had been his experience. And if you know anything about Vincent Minnelli's life, that's pretty obvious connection, I guess, in some ways. But you can really feel that in the movie. And, if you think of what this movie might have been like if Ilya Kazan had directed it as he did the Broadway show, I mean, probably would have been great, but it would have been a very different film, certainly. It wouldn't have had this soft touch that Minnelli's got, I don't think. It's because that personal feeling is there, just all through it.
Yeah, and it is. Yeah, it's personal, it's beautiful, and it's searing, right? Yeah. It's how I feel. It's even with all that shimmer, right? There's that there's that edge to it. Yeah, I just enjoyed. I enjoyed the film, Bill, because it was so, I was not familiar with it and had no expectation, right, of where it was coming from, right? And so the thought was, how come I've never seen this before, right? Yeah. I was like, I can't believe that this, and it goes to show, I think also, it complicates, right, these ideas of this 1956 moment, right? And it's complicating, right? These, as I said, it's toxic masculinity, right? But it's also an searing indictment of this kind of culture and behavior. And it makes me think of, and at that same moment, and this is just in terms of, and this is me ripping here, but it makes me think it's that same sort of feeling that all that Heaven Allows has, totally. Right?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, Douglas, they're very much cut from the same cloth as filmmakers and this film and All That Heaven Allows in particular, I think,
So that's, I was just thinking about that. And in the end, though, it is Jane Wyman, right, who ends up being able to actually live that life with Rock Hudson, right? He only has, as Jack says, Bill, he has to just, she has to fall off a cliff, right, for this to be able to sort of, happen. But yeah, it's interesting. And I also think Vincent Minnelli's, this film, we can think of it, they label the melodrama, right, as the woman's picture or weepy, but I feel like this is very much sort of a male-centric sort of melodrama. And it's, and to me, even though it's decades and cinematic moments later, it kind of makes me feel that same sort of feeling when we are confronted with like Ryan O'Neal in Love Story. Or right? So suddenly, right? This notion or these ideas of masculinity, right, are there in front of us and being sort of complicated. And even in Kramer versus Kramer, right? And so suddenly, right, that he's playing right with this the conventions of this form.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And such a exploration of identity, and in a way that I don't feel like there's many movies from the era that go that deep on in terms of identity in the same way, maybe some of those Cirque movies and but it's just stunning movie.
Yeah, and for me, and then I guess we'll wrap, Bill, the other thing, one of the things we're talking about in it is this idea that it is an open indictment, right, about toxic masculinity, but it also, even though homosexuality or queerness isn't there, it's overtly right there. If that makes
And that's one of the things that this guy talks about in his book, which is really interesting. I guess the playwright, which I can't, his name was Robert Anderson. Mm-hmm. He was very emphatic about it not being a gay play, apparently. But and I guess I don't know how much of that in the 50s was, and probably Minnelli was also kind of on that page when they were trying to make the movie. I think my feeling is a lot of that was about the production code. And if they had said that, it would have been, obviously they would not have let them make the movie probably, or they would have tried even more to drain it of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I know Minnelli later in life said, in an interview or at a film festival or somewhere, he called it the first gay movie or like that.
I would say, well, that in itself is what the production code attempts to do, right? Is sort of to silence or erase, right? These sorts of identities, but it's.
And I'll just bring up one more thing, because I think this is another way that he's so good, is that even when he has to conform to the code in the dialogue and in the action, the plot, he finds other ways to
that's right,
do this and get that across, through set design, through props, through everything else, the curtains in Tom's room. It's just like he's very careful about that stuff. And I think that allows him to give a little, in terms of the plot and the dialogue and the action, as long as he can kind of sneak that other stuff in there, he was okay. He's okay with it. And it's really, I think that's another thing that makes the movie, has made the movie age so well, because I think another director with this same material, this would be just dated in a way that would make it almost, just impossible to watch. But something about the way he did it makes it feel so relevant and just timeless, and that's a great achievement.
I do think you're right. I do think there's that sense of timelessness there, right? That, as you said, if you're still watching it now and it makes us uncomfortable, right, it's pushing us, and it's really challenging us to sort of acknowledge these sort of silences or things that perhaps that we I don't know, are equally the participants of, just like the people that are standing around like the pajama bonfire, right? It's an indictment in some way.
Hey, Bill, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for being a part of Sarahfest, and I can't wait to have you back again. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in, and keep listening.